Nicola Shrek, who is over here promoting a new edition of the Manson File.
Correct.
And we're going to talk a little bit about that and about some other projects as well. Quite a lot to get through, I guess.
Yes.
So let's begin.
Yep, pleasure to see you again.
Here's the book. Quite an extraordinary piece of work.
So this is the special edition that was printed, and I'm here in London to promote the UK edition, and this is the cover for it that will be coming out in August or September of this year. Mm-hmm. And there will be a new soft cover, hard cover, and eventually a quite extravagant deluxe edition that will be like an unprecedented artifact of Mansonia and my UK publisher, Crossbank Publishing, is publishing these. And we will be doing an event Saturday, September 24th, in which I will be showing my film, Charles Manson Superstar, giving a lecture on the British connection to the whole Manson case, which there are quite a few that people tend to think of it as a Los Angeles story, but actually its genesis and a lot of what happened started right here in London. So I'll be giving a lecture on that, showing my film, and we will be having a book launch on September 24th here in London.
I think everyone can look forward to that. Mm-hmm. But this is a work of how many years in progress? Well, I guess it's finished now, but...
Right. Hopefully finished now. And famous last words, I've said that 100 times, but this time it really does have to be the final nail in the coffin of this part of my life. It hasn't been 33 years straight of work on it, but since I met Charlie, and it really, as you'll see in the book, I have a chapter called My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, which goes back to how deeply, even into my childhood, this thing has haunted me and followed me and obsessed me. But 33 years, more or less, since I knew Charlie from the beginning of our friendship to his death, and four perambations of it, four mutations of it. In 1988, the first Manson File came out on the Muck Books in America, and then in 2011, the second edition, which was a 1,000-page mammoth re-looking at the true motives of the crime, which the first Manson File didn't really get into. That was more the first exploration of Charlie as a musician, philosopher, spiritual thinker, revolutionary. And then in 2012, I visited Charles in Corcoran State Prison, and he opened, after having read the 2011 edition, he opened up a great deal about it, and he condoned it, he approved of it, which was unheard of, really. And he opened up about aspects of his life and the crimes that he never had before, and now this 2022 edition is the final and third version of this book of revelations.
I mean, I guess there's, again, famous last words, but there's probably not that much more that can come out now from the various people involved.
That's not
more, and more of them are dying on.
Right, well, it's a fact that almost all the central figures have died. Some of them still survive, but the ones who survive will never say anything. For instance, I would be shocked if Charles Tex Watson ever says anything true, or Patricia Krenwinkel, or Leslie Van Houten, etc. But yeah, the generation that was involved with that whole phenomenon from the 60s, and Charles, you know, was 83 when he died, and so the older people that were older than him then are gone. For instance, Bob Evans, who was very much involved, the head of Paramount, who was involved in the whole cover-up of what happened at Cielo Drive, died recently. But yeah, that generation is gone. But I don't believe that... I believe more truths will continue to emerge. They do every day. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm done with my work on it, even since I finished the book, one of the major and perhaps to some people who haven't studied this thing, it would be the most shock, one of the most shocking revelations, for instance, was that John Phillips, the lead singer and front, or the founder of the Mamas and the Papas, this very winsome, cheerful, good vibrations oriented psychedelic band, not only knew Charlie very well, which he always denied, but was present at the crime scene after the murders. He actually went to the crime scene to buy drugs after the murders, thinking Sebring and Frykowski would be there, and stumbled on to the crime scene. And I describe it in my book, freaked out, went to another showbiz personality in a total state of panic, and that began this cover-up that was at the center of the, you know, the skullduggery behind the crime. And this, so that is a revelation in my book. And just only recently, I spoke to an authoritative person who's familiar with everyone involved in John Phillips' life, and he independently corroborated that story exactly as I heard it. So that's the degree to which what you have been told, what the official narrative is. You know, people think, well, we've heard this story, but no, you don't. You have not heard what really happened.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting with these cases that people almost they want to believe the official version, no matter how many holes that clearly are in those official versions.
Right. That's something I've encountered all my life with this, is that, I mean, it's like children believing in Santa Claus. They want to hang on to the whole sensational horror movie aspect of Helter Skelter, of hypnotized teenage girls under the spell of this Svengali, and none of that happened. I mean, what happened is actually just a quite typical sordid underworld crime.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That in a way, the true story is less sensational than the fake story.
Right. Well, authors are supposed to embellish and lie and make a compelling story. The fact is, I haven't done that. I'm kind of like a party pooper. I'm saying, you know, you may want to believe in this extravagant horror story about a maniacal guru who was a mind control master and who made these innocent children kill random strangers, but that never happened. And what did happen, and that's not the most important part of my book, but obviously it's the one that attracts the most attention. The Manson file is separated into seven different sections that looks at the entire Manson phenomenon. Charlie, as a musician, is taken seriously for the first time as a spiritual thinker in the chapter The Wizard, as a revolutionary, and as an outlaw. That's one chapter. And it also gets into how the media has dealt with this character, Charles Manson, this demonic being that the media created. So it covers all dimensions of the Manson story. And I want to make it clear to potential readers, it's not only a true crime book. In fact, it's not really a true crime book at all. So it's a look at this whole very strange phenomenon.
Yeah, it seems that the crime is almost a small part of the overall story.
Well, it's important, obviously, and because it's so misunderstood, I go into forensic, exhaustive detail on explaining things about the Cielo Drive and LaBianca murders that are not have never been known before. I mean, it's a much deeper, more complex story involving all kinds of underworld figures who are very obscure to the general public, and this is the first book to really get into all that in great detail.
But this isn't your only book project for the year, is it? You seem to be
No, far.
very busy.
Yeah. Well, the pandemic allowed me to be very busy. I always have been something of a workaholic, honestly. But the total lockdown in Germany, that we had a very strict lockdown, and the, you know, cessation of all outer activity allowed me to concentrate on a project I'd wanted to do for quite some time, which is to get all of my books back into, so not only the Manson file, Myth and Reality of an Outlaw Shaman, This is the final third and revised and expanded and updated version of it. The Satanic Scream, which was published here in Britain by Creation Books in 2001, a revised version came out in 2017 as Lucifer's Leinwand in Germany, but now there will be a French edition from Editions Pansouf in France. There will be an Italian edition from Edizioni Hecate in Italy, and a totally updated and revised British edition or English language edition coming out from Head Press. And like the Manson file not being merely about the crimes, the Satanic Scream is not just about the films in which the devil features, but it has a new introduction, which explains, from my point of view, as a former devil worshipper, and frankly, probably have looked more deeply into that subject than anyone I know, my final report on who is the devil. Because before you can look at what these films about him are, you have to understand, well, who is he actually? Mm-hmm. So it begins with an introduction that gets into the, you know, defining, and probably in a very surprising way, because the devil is not what people think it is, not what Christians or Satanists think he is. So that's one major feature of the Satanic Scream. And in correlation with the publication in France, Italy, and England, and there's a Spanish version of the Satanic Scream coming out from Manus Sinistra, another publisher, very deluxe, beautifully made aesthetic version that does credit to the material. And so these versions there will be a film festival in each of those countries dedicated to some of the highlights of the Satanic Scream. And hopefully I will perform a live soundtrack to one of the silent satanic films that I deal with.
Right.
So that's one book.
Do you think, by the way, is there any movie that gets it right? Any movie that comes close to...
Well, when you see what I define the devil as, not really. Because, I mean, essentially the devil that we know is a folkloric figure. There is no such metaphysical being as an adversary to the god Yahweh, who is the ruler of hell, who is the prince of darkness, who is a counterweight to God. There is no such being. The Satan is a real being who I believe I have encountered through using ceremonial magic, and he exists, or it exists, but he's not what you think it is. And I get into that in the Satanic Scream. So the figure of the devil, Satan, or Lucifer as we know it in cinema and literature is largely a literary invention. But the real being is not really anything that any film has ever presented.
Right. And so you were about to tell me about the next project.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there are many. So also Flowers from Hell, which was also printed by Creation, and then Flowers from Hell, which was also published by Creation Books in 2001, which was a literary anthology of the devil in literature, showing how the character of the devil, Satan, or Lucifer, is really a literary creation, particularly that comes from Goethe's Faust, the figure of Mephistopheles, Dante's Inferno, which is really the only reason why in the Western world we consider the devil to be the ruler over hell. There's no scriptural support for that. And the romantic idea of the devil as this great anti-hero and rebel who fought against the tyrant Yahweh, which comes based almost entirely from John Milton's Paradise Lost. And then it gets into other more obscure, lesser-known satanic literature, but it's an anthology that will be coming out on Manus Sinistra Press, and it will be a beautiful deluxe edition with color plates and expanding on the original Flowers from Hell. Then new book, those are the Manson File, Satanic Scream, and Flowers from Hell are revised, expanded, and updated editions. New books will include a book, a definitive study of Abraxas, the Gnostic god. There has strangely no one's ever really written a definitive study of who and what this god is, this Gnostic deity. That will be coming out from Anya Press in English and Edition Pensif, which is my French publisher. They actually, at this point, they exclusively publish my work in French and the work of Kenneth Grant. So that will be coming out through those two companies. I won't get into it too much because this is still a work in progress, but a general guide to magic, to the art and science of magic, because as I was saying earlier, most of what's available on that subject is rehashed regurgitation of old garbage that's really not very pragmatic, practical, or applicable. So it's my personal guide coming from my own personal experience, not only to what magic is, but how to actually do it. And I think that's a very much needed volume, even though the bookshelves are glutted with books that claim to be that.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it seems to be one of those subjects that it's the subject of choice these days, and there's so much stuff out there. So I imagine that most of the stuff that's out there, I mean, I don't know if you've actually read any of it, but it
I
just
mean,
looks disposable.
right, it's just appealing to a market, but it is almost totally, and I admit I'm a snob about this subject because I take it very seriously. I am a magician, and it's just dealt with in a very superficial, shallow, and I get the impression a lot of these studies and books about magic are not coming from a real place of initiatory knowledge and practice. A lot of it is fantasy, a lot of it is just appealing to a market. So I hope that it will be, if not the definitive guide to magic, at least show that this is a real subject, not a fantasy or an escapism, but that it's an intrinsic part of the human mind and a deep part of human culture.
So you're doing something that's the polar opposite, I guess, to the witches of Instagram. See ya.
I was going to say that the witches of Instagram or TikTok witches, I mean, it
Yeah.
has become, even in the 60s when I first, as a child, got dragged into the occult revival, there was already a certain shallowness and superficial faddishness, though there was something much more authentic going on too, as we've discussed before. Something uncanny happened in the 60s, some door opened to other worlds, and then it shut. But now it's, I mean, and like everything, every subject you can care to name has been dumbed down. The idiocracy has infected almost every subject you can name. So, the field of magic used to be something that fairly cerebral, intellectual people, even to understand it, looked into. Now, it's a lot of it has to do with what t-shirt, what tattoo. It's almost become like a brand. And that's a kind of blasphemy to something that I take seriously. So I hope that this guide to magic will be an antidote to all of that. And then there are several other books that are in the planning stages. Crossbank Books, that's printing the British edition of The Manson File, will also be publishing a book I'm working on that is a study of the evolution of of the particular femme fatale character of this black-haired, pale-skinned, vampire, demonic, witchy female in throughout history and throughout pop culture, going from, into ancient lore of religions, Lilith and that kind of thing, and then into pre-Raphaelite paintings of the femme fatale, European symbolist art, and how this figure then went into silent movies as the vamp of the 1920s, Les Fanu's Carmilla. And everyone knows this figure. You see, every gothic chick tries to embody her, like to be the avatar of her. But the real egregore of this thing, where did it come from? What was the evolution of it? So I get into like, where did Charles Adams even come up with the figure of Morticia? How did Vampyra adapt that into her persona? And I get into the lives of women who actually played these characters and how playing the characters sort of fucked up their lives. That was a kind of curse. So I get into Ingrid Pitt, Barbara Steele, and other more obscure actresses that sort of became this icon, sort of like in Nepal, where these girls become goddess for a day and then are forgotten. So I get into the spiritual dimension of this iconic vampiric femme fatale. So that's another book that we'll be working on.
Because I guess that image is one of those things that is so powerful and so iconic that the minute you become associated with it, it's hard to escape from.
And that was something I discussed with Barbara Steele, who maybe your younger listeners may not know, was like
I'm
the
sure I don't have younger listeners.
right. Well, if you do, she was like the Gothic queen of the 60s, particularly for her Italian horror films, and she resented, she did it perfectly. She was that being so perfectly that people fell in love fetishistically with that character she personified, but she herself hated being limited to being that. And so I discussed that with her, with Ingrid Pitt, who was associated with the Hammer Films' attempt at creating a more erotic vampire and the Vampire Lovers. I knew Vampyra Mylonerney was a kind of mentor to me in the 90s. I got to know her very well, and her life too was in many ways cursed. But I mean, now it's a popular icon, but it didn't do any good for her in her lifetime. So this is not a romantic puff piece about gothic imagery. It's getting into the darker side of what is it for a human being to take on this goddess-like weight and burden of this femme fatale figure.
And I guess you're talking about someone like Ingrid Pitt being made into this kind of gothic vampire figure through her work with Hammer Films. Obviously, Christopher Lee had much the same problem throughout his life, and you worked with Christopher Lee quite extensively.
And that's the final book I'll talk about, because these are all in the pretty much, finish polishing stages, and that too will be printed in Britain because it's a very British subject. So, that's a book called The Curse of the Vampire, which is about, I worked with Christopher on his first recording, Christopher Lee Sings, and in the process got to know him quite well and knew him from 1995 for about 20 years till his demise. And in the process of that, on the 100th anniversary of Dracula, I got financing for pre-production of a film that would have been a biography film of Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. And he agreed, Christopher, to play Sir Henry Irving, who was this very famous theatrical figure in Victorian times. And he was the prototype for Count Dracula. He was this very commanding, arrogant figure, very much looked like and acted like Christopher Lee. And to my surprise, because as many people know, Lee was dead set, no pun intended, to not be typecast as what he called that character. So he agreed enthusiastically to play Sir Henry Irving in this film, and to in scenes that were kind of like surreal scenes of Bram Stoker envisioning his novel, he agreed a final time to play Count Dracula as Stoker wrote it, saying the very lines that Stoker wrote and playing him as Stoker presented the character as an old man, which Lee was then in his 70s. So in the process of that, we talked about all the other productions and a lot of unknown background material about his love-hate relationship with that character. So this book is about all of the times he not only played Dracula, but played a vampire, and his struggle as a creative artist. And he was an intelligent man compared to most actors who are frankly quite shallow and superficial. He was, you know, a well-read intellectual struggling with typecasting. And so it gets into personal things about Christopher that really haven't been discussed before.
I think that's interesting because, you know, there are so many books and they all concentrate essentially on the films and the stories that we all know, whether they're true or not.
Right.
You know, just,
well, he created a lot of his own folklore about these things, frankly.
He invented Christopher Lee in a way.
Right, as every actor must, you know.
But
so this gets into the human being. What is it? It's a little bit of a companion piece to the other book about the female vampire, femme fatale, but that's more general of the icon rather than the person. But this is about one human being's struggle with the weight of being this iconic character.
Yeah, because I guess, you know, he had the same problem as I said, you know, Dracula is such a powerful role.
Right.
That it follows you throughout. And of course, you know, he made quite a lot of films.
Right.
You know, if he'd just done the one, maybe he would have got away with it. But, I mean, he did, what, six for Hammer?
Well, he did many, many obscure vampire films. Yeah. And I said to him, you know, well, you could have said no. I mean, the odd thing is he, immediately after he did the first Hammer film, he said, I don't want to be typecast. But it doesn't quite make sense because he immediately went to Italy the next year and played. It's a very good performance. It's actually quite sinister performance in an Italian comedy called, in English, Hard Times for Vampires, which very, but you know, so he was more than willing to exploit that role. So it's so I explore the contradictions and ambiguities of this legend he created.
Yeah, it's that. I guess it's that strange thing of him going to Europe to make a film about a vampire that looks just like Dracula,
right?
And then being surprised when they retitled the film Dracula,
I get into all of that, and maybe a lot of English and American readers don't know because he was multilingual and well traveled. I think he thought he could get away with, like, well, nobody in America and England will see this, so.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And also, not only that, he wrote a lot of for anthologies. He took horror seriously and wrote a lot about the vampire and about macabre literature. He did several recordings. He did, in 1966, a very ambitious LP record in which he played all the parts of Bram Stoker's Dracula. He did another one in the 70s. So, I mean, he was more deeply associated even than you think he was.
Yeah, I mean, do you think it was almost like one of those roles that he hated, but he couldn't let go of?
Yeah. He had very, and I think it's a little bit like his predecessor, who he was very aware of, Bela Lugosi. Mm-hmm. And actually, I had a very surreal experience with, I knew in the 90s, Bela Lugosi Jr., who was a lawyer, who actually was the first person to make the precedent of the law that a deceased celebrity's image belongs to their estate and to their family.
Right.
He sued Universal Studios for the Bela Lugosi Dracula and said that belongs to the Bela Lugosi estate, not to Universal. So Christopher wanted to meet him to get the rights for his estate eventually of his iconic image. Mm. And so we met at a hotel in Beverly Hills, me and Christopher and Bela Lugosi. And Bela Lugosi Jr. is the spitting image of his father.
Yeah.
So seeing Christopher Lee and Bela Lugosi's son together, people were, you know, double takes. So that's the literary work that I've done. And then musically, as of last week, I went back into the recording studio for the first time since March of 2021 when I did my album A Weird Flower, and began a new album, which I'm in the process of working with the British guitarist and bassist Jerome Alexander, Adam Mahabach in Berlin, and Heathen Ray in Berlin. So we are working on my next album now. And as the Reprobate very kindly helped to preview some of the videos we did for our former album. We'll be releasing new music this year.
Excellent. We'll look forward to that. So you've been keeping yourself quite busy during lockdown. You haven't gone stir crazy.
I have gone stir crazy, but it has helped. I mean, the first year of lockdown, I actually found a kind of relief, strangely. I thought, well, I didn't really like the way the world was going anyway, so I didn't mind that it gave me a breather. And I recorded two albums, one EP, finished the Manson file, began work on all these other books, and got a lot done. The second year, 2021, was catastrophic for me, psychically, and it was much more difficult than I thought. The first year was easy to deal with, and I found it almost like giving me carte blanche to finish whatever creative work I needed without any pressure. Yeah, but the thing that was disturbing, and we've discussed this a bit, not so much the pandemic, but watching friends of mine and lovers and business associates and people who I trusted and really thought were basically grounded and sane to the degree that anyone who would know me would be sane, going out of their mind, getting sucked into conspiracy theories of the most ludicrous, ridiculous, unbelievable kind. And that, I think, is the most disturbing thing that I witnessed during. And I put some of that into my work. For instance, the song that you premiered on The Reprobate, They and the Nice People, was sort of a critique of the extreme right and extreme woke left hysteria, ideological hysteria, which I see as pretty much the flip side of the same coin.
Well, it's that weird point when they're so far apart that they just meet again.
Yeah, well, they're similar in their intense victimization. I am a victim, and powerful forces are conspiring against me. Well, they have a different idea of what those forces are, but the basic fallacy of their thinking is that there is a master plan. And I'm quite convinced, on the contrary, the worst thing is there isn't any, and we are driving over a cliff with no driver.
Yeah, I mean that's the strange thing, the idea that we have leaders who are smart enough and powerful enough to pull all this off, and
That's exactly.
they clearly see that they can't
They
organize
can't
anything.
operate the infrastructure of how the most basic needs of a country. So, that's the point I make. How can you possibly assume that the incompetent clowns who are running the world would even be capable of the kind of, super specter, diabolical schemes that these people are fantasizing about?
And also, it just most of those schemes seem to make no sense. Like, why do they even want to do this? What power does it really give
Exactly.
them?
What the old question, qui bono, who benefits from it? I mean, there are real conspiracies. Of course, powerful people have conspired together to cover up very hideous and ugly things, but not on the scale that these people are imagining, and for very mundane, grubby, Machiavellian human purposes, not for these gigantic, idealistic, utopian, social engineering dreams that these people fantasize about.
I mean, what do you think makes people tip over the edge? Is it literally just boredom that they go online and they're looking for some kind of explanation for things that can't be explained, and somebody's going to be there to give it to them?
Right. I wish I had a glib and easy answer to that. But and you were mentioning this too earlier, I have seen very intelligent, well-educated, sane people fall into that rabbit hole and abyss. And they had fulfilling, busy lives, but they still, I mean, like a very well-known British journalist I know who was a prominent person in the rock and roll world, who you would never think in a million years would believe this kind of nonsense. He's just fallen for it hook, line, and sinker. So it isn't just boredom. I believe it's a kind of psychic pandemic. That's what we really need to worry about, is not so much the virus, but this spiritual, intellectual virus that's really reducing humanity to a very low level, and a total lack of critical thinking. So that is, I'm not going to whitewash it. I find that extremely disturbing and extremely troubling for what kind of world are we moving into.
I mean, I see it every day, and I get quite sensibly told off for, it's like, well, why are you looking at this stuff? It's like, it's just there. It just comes at me constantly. Whenever I go online, it's just there.
Well, I think I am sensitive to it and probably maybe a bit traumatized by it because in the 80s, having gone through the Satanic Panic in America and very much being a target of the same kind of witch hunting hysterical madness that is all too similar to this, but this is actually worse. It's actually more widespread. That was relatively limited to religious fanatics and law enforcement and the Reagan administration. This is so widespread and is seeping into so many areas of life.
And Satanic Panic is a part of this as well. Satanic Panic is
Oh
back
yeah.
again, that with the whole idea of, protect the children
Oh yeah,
from
that people are drinking
satanic
children's.
elites.
See, these are ancient, as you well know with your familiarity with the history of occultism. These are ancient conspiracy theories. I mean, they were going on in Paris in the so-called Paladin affair. The same thing of drinking blood and children being abused. Not, again, not that children are not being abused, but and that are there, Jeffrey Epstein's and Harvey Weinstein's exploiting women and children? Absolutely they are. But they are not doing it for some esoteric New World Order Illuminati scheme. And I have been accused in the past years more, I've always been accused of all kinds of nonsense, but in the past years more than ever of being part of the Illuminati, of being part of the global elite. I mean, laughable nonsense. So if I take it seriously, it's because it hits home.
Yeah, I mean, I've had similar things where, even if you dare to question some of this, that makes you the enemy, that makes you part
Oh,
of the people. It's like, if you question it, it must be because you're doing it.
right. Absolutely. I've had that happen. Like I criticized Brexit mildly on my Facebook page and got more hate mail in that day than I have in my entire long history of hate mail receiving, which is impressive. But that topic got more, and I said something mildly critical of the great Donald J. Trump, and that got, vicious hate mail. And then the ridiculous accusation that I must now be a communist or a liberal, which I am certainly not either, because I dare to criticize this sacred cow. So that kind of ideological extremism I've never seen in my life.
It's the odd side of this where just the smallest things set people off, and they cling to stuff that isn't important. I mean, I think the most hate mail that I got, certainly in the last couple of years, was when I dared to say that maybe people should be allowed to work from home. And that caused absolute outrage. One person accused me of trying to put shoe manufacturers out of business because, like, people work at home, then they won't be wearing shoes.
So you're, yes, even to express the most mild, reasonable opinion such as that, you become the enemy. And that's a very dangerous place we're in, this divisive, hateful attitude, which in America, which I recently visited and saw firsthand, is, on the brink of a civil war.
That's what I was just going to ask you about. I mean, America seems to just be spiraling. I mean, I think we are too here in slightly different ways, but America is just
I mean, for whatever it's worth, from my own anecdotal, subjective opinion, Britain definitely is sick post-Brexit, but it's not mortally ill. America is an empire in on its last leg. It's like Rome during the fall. I think England still has some cultural vitality and some hope, but America seems in utter decline.
I mean, what do you think has caused that? I mean, do you think this was something that was pre-pandemic? I mean, Trump was pre-pandemic, I guess, and he, that's where the division seemed to really come in.
Actually, the first time I hadn't been to America from 1999 until 2012, and that was before you ever even heard of Donald Trump, or in terms of political ambition. You knew him as a reality TV entertainer and fake millionaire. But in 2012, in California, I went out to rural California and saw that there already was a lot of hatred and a lot of brewing paranoia and conspiracy theories among people out, not in the urban centers, but a lot of fear, a lot of totally insane, maniacal, as you said, but childishly inconceivable conspiracy theories going on. And that left a bad taste in my mouth. And what I saw basically happened, like many historical movements, there was already something malevolent, like it's like a disease was already under the surface, and things like Brexit and Trump were just the manifestation of a long simmering illness
Yeah, they
that
don't come out of nowhere.
no, then they don't come out of the blue like many other historical precedents. This so I saw in 2012, and I even in the 90s you could see it. You could see this sort of thing coming, but now it's reached. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm only criticizing the so-called right, which I don't even think is really right. I'm also criticizing the woke left just as equally as in the song I mentioned, they and the nice people. Both of them are detached from reality now. Yeah, and I you know, are we moving into a new, you know, are we moving back to normal? I don't think so. I think we have entered another dimension of reality, and I think it's going to be very challenging for artists, particularly, to navigate this new world that we're in.
I think so, because now more than ever, every time you do something, there's that awareness of how people will react to it. Just the one wrong word,
Right.
one wrong description.
Right.
And that can shift from the time you wrote something to the time that it appears, can
Absolutely.
mean
Yeah,
something
and
different.
I've had that all my life. I mean, I've had my concerts banned. I've had my, you know, I've constantly, and I'm not
You were
complaining about
cancelled
that.
before it was fashionable.
Yes, I started cancel culture. Yeah, I mean, I have had, so I'm very used to it and familiar with it, but now the world has caught up with that. And it's on both sides. Both of them hypocritically pretend it's only the other side that's hysterical and overreacting, but
Yeah.
they both are in different ways. So,
I mean, I definitely saw the whole kind of the right wing support for free speech was interesting, but then of course the minute anybody said something that upset them,
oh
free
yeah,
speech was out of the window.
absolutely. The 1984 like hypocrisy and manipulate and the misuse of the left calling anybody that disagrees with them a fascist and a Nazi, which they are not. Those are real classifiable political ideas. These people are not Nazis or fascists for the most part. A lot of it has to do with just simply a lack of education, a lack of understanding of what these political terms even mean.
I
It's a
mean,
dumbing down,
yeah.
as I've said, the idiocracy that's infected everything.
What I see at the moment is that both sides are kind of shouting fascist at each other.
Right. Yes, that's
So, you
become
know,
popular
it's
too.
like, you're the fascist. No, I'm the other
Right.
fascist.
And you know, I was just in Italy and just looked at some real fascist buildings and was thinking that was an actual ideology. It has nothing, whether you hate it or love it, it had nothing to do with the word that's being screamed in 2022.
Yeah, it's a word that's lost all meaning now.
Right. It's completely means nothing. And so it should be retired, and the only people who should talk about it should be talking about these ideas of Giovanni Gentili, this forgotten Italian philosopher who defined Benito Mussolini's fascism, which was a particular economic and political system. But there's nobody at the moment, none of those people are advocating that. So, yeah, we have to, it's part of a magical understanding. You have to use words correctly. If you don't use words correctly, you breed chaos and stupidity and disorder. So on that cheerful note,
On that cheerful note, yes. Yeah, we should probably wrap things up.
Okay.
I'm sure we're going to do this again at some point,
Yes, it was a pleasure
maybe in
to.
September when you're over for. So remind us of the date when the
Yeah,
book
so
launch.
at the end you can show a title card of exactly where it will be, but it will be September 24th on a Saturday, and I will be showing my film Charles Manson Superstar. Lucky Britons will be the first to get the new soft cover and hard cover British edition of the Manson File, Myth and Reality of an Outlaw Shaman. I will be giving an extensive lecture about the London and British connections to the whole Manson phenomenon, which are quite extensive, a Q&A, and a festive book launch in the old tradition, as one used to have at Foyles or something, that kind of thing.
And I think after you've done that, when that's out, so that we're not spoiling any surprises,
Right.
I'm sure people might have a slight idea where you're going with this anyway. But we can talk more maybe about the whole British connection then.
Absolutely. Yeah, we can do that in September. So thank you for inviting me. Wonderful to see you again after this unwanted hiatus of the pandemic. And all the best to you and your viewers.
Thank you very much, and see you again soon.
Okay, thank you.